I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to I Could Murder a Podcast, the series finale, episode number 12. We have made it all the way here with you guys by our side. Thank you for joining us throughout this series. And I'm joined by the slushy serpent, spooky sleazy, swamp swimming, shifty sloth, Sergeant Simp, Ben Carter.
That was absolutely fine until Sergeant Simp. I was quite happy with that. My terribly tiresome, tightly tempered, tedious titty twister, tragic trivia guy, Tommy Norris. It's been snowing for years and I've finally made a snowball.
What?
Kind of.
It's like at the end, there's just slush on the floor and you kind of make a half one and then it just melts in your
threw
hand.
Threw it at him and it, just sprayed my trousers.
Oh dear.
How are we doing, boys?
Very good. Well done, Ben, for that, you know. Well done.
I was nervous about... I was nervous.
Sergeant Simp.
Fair play.
That is brutal.
Terrible, isn't it? Sergeant Swamp Simp. Swimming was quite cute.
I was going to do sorry sack of shit, but then I didn't. So I thought, you know what? Last episode, I'm not going to be mean, but I'll still get it in there.
Yeah.
But yes, we are here. We are here to celebrate Series 9 with a final episode, one slightly lighter.
So we want to say a huge thank you to everyone for showing us some love throughout Series 9. It's been a very enjoyable series, lots of different cases, and our finale is one that probably nobody saw coming. And a special shout out, I have to get this in nice and early, to Joe Barrett, because the last three or four seasons that we've done an audience vote, Joe always gets the Great Train Robbery in there. And the first time we saw it, we thought, do you know what, Joe? That's a bloody good shout. So here it is. We hope you enjoy it, Joe. Nice one for the shout. We wouldn't have even considered this case without you. So gotcha. You're implicated now. You're part of the gang.
And Ben, do you want to remind everyone what the clue was?
The cryptic clue, of course, was Francis Bourgeois is going to be fuming. And yeah, rightly he would be. I mean, I'm not sure where he'd stand based on the controversies around character and not character, but I feel like he'd be quite upset at this week's case.
I think he would be. He'd be definitely team police and team train, which, yeah, this case is a fascinating one. It's steeped in a lot of conjecture, I'd say, how people tell the stories and spin the yarn. And it's kind of similar to some stories, I guess, around the craze, where over time, maybe it's become a little bit more fantastical rather than it was, just to kind of make the story even more interested. But yeah, it's definitely a very intriguing one and a very, very British one.
Yeah, a very British case indeed. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of room for us to be... We've gone through a dark few weeks in terms of different cases and minisodes we've covered. It's going to be one that I think we can have a little bit of fun with as well, a little bit of light relief with. It is, of course, the Great Train Robbery, also known as the UK's most infamous heist, the life and crimes of Ronnie Biggs and Co. The £58 million men, very heavy, England's most famous robbers, and the heist of the century.
Yes, indeed. We've done planes, now we're doing trains, and maybe in the next series we'll do cars.
Do you know what's funny? I was going to say, I'm a big fan of trains. They're probably number two on my list of favourite method of transport. I think planes would be number one, trains would be number two, and cars would be number three. So,
have you seen the film?
Like we planned it.
So why do you drive? Why don't you just get one of them?
Easier, mate.
Fair, fair. Bikes last?
Fuck bikes.
I don't know. I could see him on a cycle.
Yeah, a little motorbike.
Oh, push bike.
Oh, motorcycle, maybe. A push bike, no. Mm. They really annoy me when I see him on the road.
Actually, I could see you in Oscar's sidecar on a motorbike, like Wallace and Gromit.
Fucking Wallace and Gromit.
And as usual, we like to set the scene with producer Dan. So please, Dan, take the floor. The voice, Dan Lambert, for the last time in this series. Take the floor.
As the moon casts a faint glow over the quiet Buckinghamshire countryside, a sense of anticipation quietly fills the air. The sound of an approaching train grows louder, with its rhythmic chugging echoing through the early hours of the summer's morning. Suddenly, several masked figures emerge from the shadows and make their way towards the tracks, their movements swift, silent, and calculated. With precision and audacity, the group of men leap into action, placing a single glove over the track's green signal light, dimming it, and using a battery to ignite the red light, bringing the approaching locomotive to a screeching halt. The Great Train Robbery is officially underway. In a flurry of activity, bags of cash and hundreds of high-value packages are snatched from the train's secure carriage, with the gang of robbers working quickly and carefully to evade any form of detection. The robbers astonish even themselves as they manage to unload more than 2.5 tons of money before making their escape into the darkness. The hunt immediately begins for Britain's newest and most wanted millionaire bandits.
Choo-choo, Thomas! Stop it.
So yeah, in doing the research for this episode, I was initially back in the day as a kid, I saw the movie Buster, which really tries to sort of glorify, and as you said, it has been very much celebrated, this crime, although there were people majorly affected by it. I watched the movie Buster and remember thinking, wow, that's quite clever how they planned it all and they did it all. But then actually doing the research, some of it is very sort of not complex whatsoever. It's very sort of, you know, pop a glove over the light, boom, let's go and get it. I know it's more than that, but the research in terms of the what they do after the incident itself, after the fact, is, I find that part fascinating. Yeah. But also all the different gang members and what they bring to the gang and why they were recruited is also quite interesting. And I might have a little surprise for Tom and Dan towards the end of the episode around gang recruitment. So stay tuned.
Oh, wow. Stay tuned for that. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. It's kind of been, some people like to portray it kind of as the Ocean's 11 kind of team brought together for this mission, when it's kind of a bit more bumbling fools in certain aspects. And they make some grave errors, some very rogue decisions, get a little bit cocky. But yes, it is a very interesting one. And it's one that at the time, which is quite surprising, it divided a lot of people. Some people wanted the crooks to go away with it. Some people wanted the cops to find them. So yeah, it's a very interesting case.
And as always, a quote to start us off. And yeah, there are some fun ones for producer Dan this week. And this comes from very infamous heist member, Ronnie Biggs.
There's a difference between criminals and crooks. Crooks steal. Criminals blow some guy's brains out. I'm a crook. Just an ordinary crook. It has been rumoured that I was the brains of the robbery, but that was totally incorrect. And I've been described as the T-boy too, which is also incorrect. I'm just a guy that dared to do what nobody else did.
So there'll be a lot more from Ronnie later in the case. But yeah, straight off the bat, Tom, what I found quite jarring is I assumed Ronnie Biggs would have a much larger role in this case than what he actually did. And I think it's probably more so what he did afterwards that gave him the name and the fame. But yeah, very minor role in the gang.
Yeah, not as Ronnie, bigger part as we expected. I think you could say Ben if you wanted to be hilarious. But we're going to take a look in detail at the Great Train Robbery, the individuals involved and how it came about, the planning, the execution, the manhunt, and the aftermath in what we think will be a pretty enjoyable series finale.
So to understand how the Great Train Robbery came to be, we need to first understand what England was like during the early 1960s. And good thing is, most of it's still sort of in the back of my mind from when we covered the Cray twins. So I've got
just from your childhood.
No. I was not even, I don't even know if I was brewing at that point, you know, in terms of my dad.
I don't like the idea if your dad's brewing.
My dad, dad wasn't even born then.
Oh, so you were inside.
I was the sperm in a sperm type of thing.
Interesting.
What we're going to do is look at what was going on in the lives of the individuals that would later form the 17-man gang. Most parts of England were going through significant changes with the emergence of the swinging 60s, and as we explored in our Crate Wins episode earlier this series, London in particular became a bit of a hub for all of these new cultural, social and political changes, with hundreds of thousands of people flocking to the capital to experience the scene of swinging London. Whilst there were a lot of things to be positive about, including rising wages, the civil rights movement, huge advances in technology, a strong economy, and the arrival of iconic music, The Who, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles were on the charts everywhere, in your ears, in your face, and also a rising fashion, art and film scene. So despite all of the positive elements in this movement, there were still a great number of people living a life of poverty, desperation, and in some cases, crime. As I've already mentioned a couple of times, the Cray twins were spearheading organised crime in London's ganglands, with regular acts of robbery, violence, racketeering and extortion happening all over the city. This saw numerous other criminal gangs sprouting up all around the country, resulting in a significant rise in violent crimes, associated arrests and a steep increase in the prison population. Amongst London's heavily overcrowded and heavily outdated prisons were career criminals, petty thieves, con men, street gang members and murderers, some of whom began networking. They believed that the rich were quickly becoming richer, whilst the divide between the haves and have-nots was becoming wider than ever before. Crime writer of the time, Jim Nicholson, recalled the following.
We had our famous Cray twins running London on one side and a couple of small-time gangs on the other. There was a lot of heavy action. Armed robberies, payroll stuck up, banks were being stuck up. You couldn't go out on a Thursday morning in the 60s without a bank being robbed.
Just a quick one. Stuck up just means like, this is a stick up. And they rob. It's not them being up their own arse and being like, oh, you want that money, do you? Good luck. If anyone thought that, I'm just explaining to you, it wasn't that. Even those with power and money, it was deemed the high society were not above becoming immersed in scandal during the 60s. The infamous Profumo affair of 1963 came to light just a few months before the Great Train Robbery. The scandal shocked not only a nation, but the world, when the British Secretary of State for War, 46-year-old John Profumo, was caught having an affair with a 19-year-old model, Christine Keeler. Christine, who was a notable partygoer and socialite, was also at the time involved in a romantic relationship with 35-year-old Captain Yevgeny Ivanov, a high-ranking Soviet Navy intelligence official.
Sounds like a poisonous little triangle there.
News of this affair not only caused a huge amount of controversy, the newfound awareness of this bizarre love triangle actually caused a national security risk. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Your dirty laundry literally causing your nation to be at risk.
And you're the Secretary of State for War.
Mm.
Couldn't make it up.
So heavy was the scandal, the famous osteopath Stephen Ward, who introduced Christine to both Profumo and Ivanov, later went to trial on allegations of essentially being a pimp. Just before he was sentenced, he took an overdose of sleeping pills before being found dead just 4 days later as a result of suicide by barbiturate poisoning.
This was a huge scandal at the time. The amount of information out there about this is significant, but a big reason that this all came to light and how Profumo was caught in the first place was that a handwritten letter of his that he wrote for Christine. I feel like it's not been proven, so I'm not making any kind of allegation here, but it is pretty well believed that Christine leaked these handwritten messages to the News of the World, who then in turn published the letter. And I read the letter and thought, I can't not do this episode without producer Dan doing Profumo's voice here for the letter. And all he's doing is sort of cancelling a date the night before. But I just thought the way that he's done it is, very... Very, he's got a way with words, this Profumo, and maybe that's why she liked him.
How do you want it, Ben?
Oh,
my darling.
You are, let me set the scene. You're a 46-year-old Secretary of the State for War. You've got a 19-year-old model. Unfortunately, something's come up. Your wife's taking you to see her family for dinner, and you can't make a hot date with Christine tomorrow, so you need to let her know.
Let me add some more to it.
Yeah,
to
think, sure.
Yeah,
I'm being kind.
You're an overweight man who likes to eat a lot of pheasant and drink a lot of red wine. Loads of acid reflux, sorry. You're loads of acid reflux.
Yeah. I've got a lot of that, to be fair.
Darling, alas, something's blown up tomorrow night, and therefore I can't make it. I'll leave the next day for various trips and then a holiday, so I won't be able to see you again until sometime in September. Blast it! Please take great care of yourself and don't run away. Love, Jay.
Don't run away.
Yeah. Blast it. So yeah, big scandals in the upper class, a growing divide in the middle class, and then still a great deal of petty crime and poverty in the lower class. And also, yeah, blast it. You sounded a bit like Stewie Griffin when you did that, Dan.
Did I?
You did a bit. Like an older Stewie.
So not like Stewie.
But kind of like Stewie, though.
A different character.
He's literally a baby, isn't he?
Well, yeah, yeah. And
it was an English accent.
Yeah. Yeah, blast it also regularly being used as an expletive. So, yeah, great time. Surprised drat wasn't in there as well. Drat's a good old one, isn't it? Drat.
Drat!
Though the team of great train robbers would eventually be made up of 17 men, with two of their identities remaining highly divisive to date and two still completely unknown, it is not exactly clear how each member came to know one another. Predominantly, the great train robbers met through various connections within the criminal underworld, often crossing paths through their involvement in previous criminal activities or even getting recommendations. So yeah, a lot of them had worked previous jobs together, whilst others had been recommended by, you know, a network of different criminals. Many of the key figures in the heist, such as Bruce Reynolds, Buster Edwards, Charlie Wilson and Gordon Goody, had established reputations as skilled thieves and organised criminals. They were known to frequent the same social circles, pubs and nightclubs where they would regularly discuss potential heists and recruit accomplices for their schemes. So yeah, we talked in our craze episode about their pub, their Regal Club, where a lot of other criminals started drinking and hanging out. We talked about the lost property in there would have been quite lethal. But yeah, that was the thing at the time. Sort of working man's establishments, they would go in and basically concoct a little heist.
Yeah, on some of the documentaries I watched, they were talking about how these men obviously weren't people who fought in the war. The generation just after the war, kind of in a bit lost in direction and kind of feeling they maybe weren't able to kind of do as much as their relatives, and kind of they wanted to leave their mark, but also they're growing up in that kind of the after ripples of the war. So it's a bit of a different time in terms of mentality. And people wanting to make a name for themselves in any way possible, really.
As well as this, some members of the gang had prior associations with each other, or as we mentioned, they'd worked together on previously less legitimate jobs, forging strong bonds and friendships with one another as a result. So yeah, they would only basically bring on board people that they trusted and that had worked with previously, or at least someone could vouch for them. Ultimately, the great train robbers came together through a combination of their shared interests. As Tom said, they all came, a few of them were quite lost in their lives. They had a desire for financial gain at a time when they believed the opportunity to never have been bigger before. Though claims from different members would vary, it is widely believed that the initial idea of the robbery came from Gordon Goody, as well as Charlie Wilson and Bruce Reynolds, who had received a very lucrative tip-off.
It's funny, the recommendations and needing to have, like, being vouched for. Trustatrainrobber.com. That's what they needed. Yeah, it's funny, like, because no honour amongst thieves and all that, but they really take the word of other people, and yeah, I guess obviously you are creating bonds because you trust one another not to grasp the other person and all that, so it's high stakes indeed. And I have to say, like, one thing watching documentaries on this, some of the old pictures of them when they're younger and stuff like that look so iconic in terms of the looks and the styles and stuff like that.
I found it really really jarring that there was a Channel 4 documentary I watched where a lot of them were still alive. It was like, I think it was a 1999 documentary, and I just found it, they all speak very eloquently. They don't, in my mind, when I hear how they recruited the gang and what different members were recruited for, I expected them to maybe be a little bit rough around the edges, but they're all, like, particularly Reynolds and Goody, they're very, like, I could listen to them talk about anything. They were very, like, they're great vocab, great voice. Goody had a bit of a fancy look about him, had like a plaid scarf. Yeah, I didn't expect that. I found it jarring.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like Michael Caine-esque, isn't it? Sometimes with really Cockney people, they get so Cockney that they kind of get to the point where it sounds quite posh in terms of how they speak. Certain words they really pronounce, and there's a lot of character within the voice. But yeah, it's a very easy thing to say, but you can imagine this obviously being done by like a Guy Ritchie kind of thing, and all the characters are very Guy Ritchie when you look at it. During the spring of 1963, Reynolds with his Southwest gang associates, Ronald Buster Edwards and Gordon Goody, had been informed by an unidentified senior security officer who worked for the Royal Mail about an upcoming travelling post office train that was due to be travelling from Glasgow to London overnight. This source was apparently put in touch with them via London-based solicitor's clerk Brian Arthur Field in return for a small cut of the takings. The train itself, named Up Special, was believed to be carrying, according to the source, More money than you could imagine, at least 1 million British pounds, but it could be up to 6 million, which immediately piqued the interest of the group. Just a few months prior, in November of 1962, Reynolds, Buster and Goody had robbed a payroll shipment at a London airport, taking a cool £62,000 in the process, which, in today's money, is 1.65 million, which is, that's insane that that's that much, isn't it?
They did it in such a, they basically became known as the Bowler Hat Gang, because it was, yeah, it was, as you said, the Guy Ritchie point is, that's a very good reference to make. They were all dressed up in sort of high fashion. They had bowler hats on, big black suits, and basically it was kind of Ocean's 11 in a way. They rocked in and basically conned their way to getting this payroll shipment and then straight out without harming anyone. And they immediately were dubbed the Bowler Hat Gang in the press, and the general public absolutely lapped it up. So despite that, 1.65 million, they still wanted a lot more.
So soon after learning of this, Bruce Reynolds basically made himself the brains of the operation, whilst Gordon Goody and Buster Edwards immediately insisted that fellow South West Gang member Charlie Wilson be brought in on the planning element of the heist. Between the four of them, they had orchestrated and committed numerous successful robberies and burglaries in the past, but never something as drastic as robbing a moving target, or even trying to stop or board a train illegally. In order to overcome this, the group made the joint decision to share the valuable intel with select members of another London gang called the South Coast Raiders. With four members of the gang having previously robbed trains effectively and considering themselves seasoned veterans and the pirates of the train tracks, which is a great name. Bruce Reynolds, the group's self-appointed mastermind, recalled the following.
The people I was mixing with at the time were very much what I would term gentlemen of crime. Virtually all of them wore Savile Row suits, and they were all driving cars like Jaguars, Alvises, and Bentleys. We mixed with the rich, and we robbed from the rich. I was beginning to see the thief as an artist. Nothing could match the tension, excitement, and sense of fulfillment.
So yeah, I found how this all came to be is this, basically this guy, Brian Arthur Field, who was very well respected in his own field. He got this tip off that a great amount of money was going to be coming down from Scotland to London on this train. And he wasn't very law-abiding, shall we say, himself, despite being, you know, financially sound and successful in his own career. He took this idea, before going to Goody and Reynolds, he took this idea to the Cray twins, or at least a senior member of the Cray twins firm, and it was Freddie Brownbread Fred Foreman, who basically said, look, this is robbing something, you know, still like a bank or a shop they can do, but robbing a train, just, we don't, his literal words were, we didn't really fancy it too much. So this was, yeah, this was quite a new, although some trains had been robbed previously in the years building up to this, nothing as big as this on as grand a stage as this had been done before. So the group of four quickly became a group of eight, but this still was not enough people. The group added an additional nine members to their gang whilst trying to keep the operation a complete secret. This included what they deemed as several men to provide extra muscle, as well as multiple lookouts and getaway drivers. Also brought back in on the act was solicitor's clerk Brian Arthur Field, and they basically, although he provided them with the intel, they still needed his expertise to arrange for the purchase and conversion of Leverslade Farm, which was a somewhat remote farmhouse with a small piece of surrounding land and outbuildings, which was located in Oakley, Buckinghamshire. And the reason for this location is they wanted to use that as their hideout because it was far enough away from London, but not too far away from the train tracks, in that the group could hide quickly and concisely. So they needed Brian basically to arrange for the purchase and deal with all the above board legalities on that. The group of chief organisers began extensively staking out the train tracks along the routes that the UP special was likely to take. And whilst doing this, they studied the train's schedules, railway signals, and potential locations for the robbery. They were trying to select the most suitable location to both bring the train to a stop and then to be able to safely ambush it, whilst also being able to load up nearby escape vehicles with ease and a lack of detection. Eventually, after months of research and a lot of arguments, the group settled on the location of Sears Crossing, and they decided that this would be the point that they would force the train to a halt to then board it, take control of it, and drive it a further 800 metres forward to Bridigo Bridge, a secluded location where they would have waiting trucks and vehicles to load up with their loot before escaping. So yeah, this was basically, it was a bridge wherein roads went underneath it for cars, and there was enough access on the hillside for them to sort of be able to man a human chain down to the vehicles there. So that was, for them, the perfect location. So as we mentioned, something on this scale had never really been done before, and so Bruce Reynolds was extremely keen to make sure that the group were made up of the right individuals and that everybody was able to perform correctly in the right roles. He said the following.
In the early 60s, crime was very much more finessing. One didn't sort of take abnormal chances, and, of course, this was an area that I perhaps fit in better as being a younger man. I was quite prepared to take the chances that perhaps my mentors weren't, which, of course, is every young man's ambition to be one of the big boys, and that's how you become one of them, by doing the things that others won't do.
So let's get to know the gang a little better. Each member of the gang was aged between 29 and 43 years old at the time of the robbery, though one unidentified individual, referred to as Pops, was believed to be the oldest of the group by some distance at 69. It's kind of like our dynamic in here. The majority of the gang had either a criminal or military background and were from South London. Just throw it over to Pops.
So first up, we have Bruce Richard Reynolds, a.k.a. The Brain, and also known as Napoleon. So he was the leader, or self-appointed leader, of the gang. Reynolds first became involved in crime from the age of 17 when he worked as a bicycle messenger. He spent a lot of time from this point onwards in Borstal's, HMP Wormwood Scrubs and Wandsworth Prison, and these were all results of being charged with theft and other petty crimes. He then spent many years befriending rich people in the countryside before later burgling their farmhouses, and was also arrested for holding up a bookmaker's at a greyhound racetrack. He spent many years trading and stealing antiques before eventually meeting Gordon Goody and Buster Edwards at a club in London that was run by eventual enemies to the craze, the Richardson Gang. So yeah, from this point onwards, Goody, Edwards and Reynolds, they became kind of inseparable, and they launched numerous different little heists together, so they became very, very close.
So thick as thieves.
Yeah, you could say that, yeah. Mm-hmm,
definitely. Charles Charlie Frederick Wilson, a.k.a. Gorgeous Charlie, and also a.k.a. the Silent Man. Charlie was given the title of Treasurer of the Gang due to his organisational skills and attention to detail. As well as this, he seemed to command respect wherever he went. Charlie had given up on what he viewed as a boring mainstream life, working at his father's grocers, and instead opted for a life of crime and gambling. He helped organise the London Airport payroll robbery with Bruce Reynolds, and also helped the South Coast Raiders to successfully rob a train in Swindon. Charlie's ultimate responsibility would be eventually split up the gang's takings and divide them into relevant payouts for each member's share. He was called Gorgeous Charlie and Charlie Charmin due to his very vivid blue eyes, large frame, intimidating nature, and so often being described as handsome by those that met him. He's also been described as, by far, the most dangerous member of the group.
See, I wouldn't give the responsibility of dividing up the money to the most dangerous man.
Maybe he didn't have a choice.
That's true. Yeah, I'm doing this. Okay, Charlie. Yeah. All right.
I'd prefer you not do it, Charlie, but I'm not going to do anything about it. And here's my lunch money.
So next up, we have Douglas Gordon Goody. Together with Buster Edwards, Gordon Goody was Bruce Reynolds' main man. Gordon was a notorious and successful member of the Southwest Gang and had been involved in leading the London Airport payroll robbery of 1962. Gordon was regularly described as the most quiet, shy and meticulous member of the group, but one that would always get the job done. He was also known as the most gentlemanly armed robber and safe blower in all of London. This is the one that, yeah, in the Channel 4 documentary I watched, he really, it's bad to say it about a thief and a criminal, but he comes across really, really well in this documentary. And even when he's describing the eventual, the one individual that is actually physically hurt by these actions, he's even like, oh, it's just a bop on the head, old chap. He could be a good Bond, or he could have been a good Bond back in the day. Authorities that would then eventually investigate the Great Train Robbery, and many people today believe that Goody was actually the true mastermind behind the operation.
Good Bond.
He would be a good Bond, I think. Oh, shit.
So that was Douglas Gordon Goody, or as Ben likes to refer to as the next James Bond. We'll pop a picture of him up now. I disagree. Ronald Christopher Edwards, a.k.a. Buster Edwards. Buster had lived a very varied life to this point of 1963. He was one of the few people that could say that they had been a semi-professional boxer, a nightclub owner, and a runner of a flower shop.
Buster had mainly been involved in petty crimes, stealing cigarettes, clothing and alcohol, but seemingly wanted more and more after being involved in the airport payroll robbery like Gordon, Charlie and Bruce. Buster had been described as one of the most unpredictable members of the group.
So then we have Ronnie Arthur Biggs, and this is perhaps the biggest and most infamous name on the list, but what surprises many is that his responsibility and rank within the gang was almost minuscule. Biggs had been to prison for stealing a car from his neighbourhood and had also been involved in a failed robbery attempt of a betting shop in London. When he was sent to Wandsworth Prison for this, he met Bruce Reynolds and the pair became acquaintances. After leaving prison, Biggs tried to live a normal, law-abiding life as a carpenter, but he wasn't earning the type of money that he had hoped for. However, in 1962, he just so happened to work at the house of a retired train driver, and this is Pops, who will go on to discuss in the timeline, quite a comical figure with what happens. Many people believe Pops to have been a man named Stan Agate. Biggs, who was aware of Bruce Reynolds' plan to eventually rob a train, informed him that he could bring Pops in on the action. So basically, Biggs went over to Bruce Reynolds and said, look, I know a great train driver. He's your man. He'd be interested in earning a quick few grand. He can get the job done. So basically, Ronnie Biggs's role within this whole operation was that he would bring along a train driver for the heist that could basically move the train the last 800 meters. So yeah, many people did not like Ronnie Biggs or the fact that he had made his way onto the team, with Ronnie Biggs' official role in the whole of the Great Train Robbery being the driver and contact of the robbery train driver. So yeah, all he had to do was recruit and bring along a driver, and he would get his, you know, over £1.5 million for this action, which is crazy.
Brian Arthur Field. Mr. Field is the solicitor's clerk who first leveraged the idea and information of the high-value train to some members of the group. He was the only member of the group not to physically partake in the robbery. Mr. Field was already very rich and successful on his own merit, but seemingly had an appetite for the darker side of life. Kind of imagine in this kind of Saul Goodman kind of vibe. Field lived in an impressive farmhouse in the countryside and would regularly host and attend parties with his equally wealthy neighbours. Field would feed information about his neighbours' house layouts and valuables to Goody and Buster Edwards, who would in turn burgle his neighbours and kick back a finder's fee to him. That's... yeah.
Yeah.
You can see that in the film playing out very very well as well. So it's all very quaint, but... because it's, I think it's that's the thing. It's like, and I think that's what happened at that time. When you know it's happening to rich people, you feel slightly less aggrieved, which is, it shouldn't be right. But you're kind of like, oh, fuck it, they're rich. Stealing from someone probably comes from old money and has inherited that house. But still, yeah. Field had also helped to purchase Leverslade Farm for the group to use as a hideout and had arranged for the legal defence of Goody and Buster previously.
We then have Roger John Caudry, a very interesting figure in this case. We mentioned earlier that some members of the South Coast Raiders gang kind of considered themselves veteran train robbers, pirates of the tracks. Roger was one such person. Not only was he a senior member of the South Coast Raiders, but he was also introduced to them as literally the most accomplished train robber and track expert that the gang had. But when we actually get to the timeline, we'll see just how intricate and elaborate that Roger's skills were.
And it wouldn't be a train robbery without Thomas Tommy William Wisby, one of the leaders of the South Coast Raiders gang. Tommy was known to many members of the gang as a popular and successful con man and burglar. He was brought on due to his size and stature and impressive record when it came to bar fights and arranging smaller heists. He was the first member recruited by the gang as additional muscle in return for him allowing Roger Caudry to help them out.
We then have Roy John James. So Roy was known to some members of the gang as somewhat of a motor enthusiast, amateur mechanic, and someone who knew a thing or two about racing cars, having the occupation of a Formula 3 driver.
Mm-hmm.
What's that? Just a little bit slower than Formula 1?
Slower than Formula 2.
So yeah, definitely. Well, he was brought on specifically as a getaway driver, but had the additional responsibility of being one of the group's leading carriage uncouplers. Yeah, which with the carriage uncouplers, basically their main role was to separate carriages from one another on the trains.
The little clicky bits between, connects.
You just pull a pin out, don't you?
Easy as that. You're really belittling Ron John James's role here, Ben.
Oh, yeah.
Again, what would a heist be without John Thomas Daly? John was known to the group via Bruce Reynolds. The pair were brother-in-laws and had worked in the slightly less common, illegitimate antiquing world together. Bruce knew John as someone reliable and someone that knew the local roads well. So he too was brought on as a getaway driver.
Just a getaway driver, though. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's giving your brother-in-law a little bit of an easy gig.
Yeah.
Your family.
But maybe he doesn't trust him in the wife. Like, get him involved. It's like, oh, he knows the roads well. Oh, fuck. All right. Stay in the car.
Oh, gosh.
We then have James Edward White. So White had one of the more looked down upon roles in the gang in that he was recruited specifically to arrange and look after the group's hideout as well as their food and well-being, having had previous experience in looking after military barracks. So yeah, basically sort of a chef and a cleaner and there for morale as well, I feel. Just to, you know, look after people, keep their chins up. He was also brought along to support Roy John James as an additional carriage uncoupler. White was added to the group by Bruce Reynolds, as he had previously acted as a lone thief over the last decade, which resulted in the pair spending time in prison together. So they'd become close friends. And I think, yeah, James Edward White was someone that Reynolds definitely wanted on the team.
Danny Pembroke. Pembroke was a bit of a utility player. He could do a little bit of everything. But yeah, kind of like a James Milner. He was initially brought on as extra muscle due to his reputation as a fearsome intimidator for the South Coast Raiders, but he was also a South London taxi driver by trade and a former military man, so he was considered for roles as a getaway driver and carriage and coupler. Pembroke was described as the most careful member of the group, especially when it came to leaving any evidence behind. He was the only gang member never to get caught.
Probably because of how careful he was.
Yeah, you would have thought so. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. We then have James Big Jimmy Hussey. So Big Jim was part of a small group of the accomplished train robbers that were brought in from the South Coast Raiders, having previously robbed a Royal Mail train in Swindon. As he was a childhood friend of Charlie Wilson's, he was brought on immediately as muscle to be one of the first people to breach the train upon it being forced to stop. His skills and experience would not let the team down.
And finally, in terms of members of the gang that we know the names of, Robert Bob Welch. Not a great deal of information was available about Bob. He is one of the last men brought on board the heist team and was brought on as backup muscle. Also believed to have been involved, we have Patrick McKenna or Sammy Osterman. Though it's never been confirmed, these are the two names most commonly given to the senior security officer who worked for the Royal Mail and who provided the group with a tip-off regarding the multi-million pound train. Gordon Goody, one of the group's leaders, is adamant that it was Patrick McKenna and at the time 43-year-old senior postal worker based in the Lancashire area, and that the group met him four separate times. Whilst Sammy Osterman, meanwhile, is a name that never has been properly identified with anybody, dead or alive, but was put forward as a name by Tommy Wisby.
So then there's a couple more members of the gang to discuss. The first one, or unofficial members of the gang, shall we say, Henry Thomas Smith, a.k.a. Harry, and also a.k.a. Flossie. So he's believed to have been an additional carriage on coupler brought along by the South Coast Raiders, who hadn't been in any of the previous meetings, but they just brought him along. So this is how Henry Thomas Smith's name was associated with the gang. And apparently he still got a cut of the share, but was later never identified formally. We then have Stan Agate, a.k.a. Pops, and also a.k.a. Petey. So, yeah, probably my favourite character in this case. As we mentioned earlier, Ronnie Biggs just happened to have been doing some carpentry work for Pops in the months leading up to the heist. Pops, who was a retired train operator, was brought in to help drive the train the extra 800 metres that the gang required in order to complete their daring heist. So basically, the biggest job is on Pops here. Just get it over the line and we'll all go home happy. So we'll see how Pops gets on. So we have our gang, we have our plan, we have our hideout, and we have our train. It is here that we move to the timeline of the Great Train Robbery.
In sync, brilliant.
That wasn't in sync.
Very good.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wednesday, the 7th of August, 1963, at 6:50 p.m, the travelling post office train Up Special departs Glasgow Central Station on time and begins its slow 9-hour and 10-minute overnight journey down to London Euston Station. The train consisted of 12 separate carriages, including the one particular high-value package's Royal Mail carriage, which was located two carriages back from the train's engine. On the train were 72 post office staff members who were present on the train in order to sort the mail as it headed towards London, as well as two train drivers, 58-year-old Jack Mills, the main driver, and his second man, 26-year-old David Whitby. When watching this, I never knew that the postal trains existed and people would actually be on there sorting the post out as it goes. For some reason, the job of sorting a post out in a stationary building seems boring as fuck. But on a train, it makes you go, oh, yeah, that could be quite fun. Mm. And I don't know why. It shouldn't make it any more fun, because all you're doing is still just doing the same thing. But
well, we get pretty bad motion sickness, don't we? So I don't know how good we'd be if we were trying to focus on...
Yeah, I think I can read in a car or a train and not feel weird. So I think I'd be all right with that. But an interesting note to make about the train, as well as the high value packages carriage it was carrying. Between 1960 and 1963, due to an increased number of low level train robberies, many of whom were likely carried out by the South Coast Raiders gang, the Post Office Investigation Branch had made a series of investigations and subsequent recommendations regarding carriage security in order to prevent further robberies. They first suggested that teams of security guards or police officers to be hired to patrol the trains whilst they make the journey, but this was quickly deemed out of budget.
This bit here is just like ridiculous in terms of all the things that should have been on this train that weren't, because they used a reserve train for this amount of money. It's mental.
They recommended the fitting of alarms in all travelling post office trains, as well as high-value package carriages. They recommended bars to be placed all over the windows and doors to be fitted with double lock catches, and they also recommended the installation of radio systems to be used between multiple carriages, the drivers and local police. Sadly for those operating the train line, this particular train was a reserve, which is a slightly outdated model, and so it had none of these features. And those in power deemed the use of radio systems to be too expensive for the old models to be worth it, which is an interesting take. All of this would fall incredibly well to the advantage of the robbers.
So even, I mean, what have they made? 4 or 5 different recommendations there. Even just one of them being in place would have changed all of the course of what's about to happen. But they deemed it to be out of budget. Even when we're going to say how much money this train was carrying, how they don't have security on there, any kind of security, no locked doors, it just...
Yeah,
baffling.
Yeah, the lack of security on there. Like, I mean, apparently... It was seen as kind of tradition. They didn't need it. Nothing to this extent had ever happened before. And so this high value, you know, the high value items, they didn't feel it was under much threat. And it kind of just was like, oh, that's just how we do it. We don't have security on there. It goes overnight. It's on a train. Who's going to rob a train? And even at the probably the time that it was going as well, they thought that it'd be less likely. But yeah, it's very peculiar. I guess everything takes the first thing to go wrong in order for them to implement new things, but still, it seems very naive.
That's true. I also think probably they thought nobody else apart from the Royal Mail knows that this is happening.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously there'd been a leak, so... Yeah. But I just found that they'd been given all of this advice and they'd... Yeah. No, it's fine. Put our biggest delivery of the year on this old train.
The first 8 hours of the journey went without a hitch. The journey was smooth and uninterrupted. The mail had almost been ready to arrive in London, was almost entirely organised, and the two drivers were fast approaching the end of their shift. As it had just been a bank holiday weekend, there was a huge amount of extra mail on board the train, and a huge amount of extra high-value packages too. As the train approached Shears Crossing, located between Leighton, Buzzard and Cheddington, the two drivers noticed what appeared to be a red stoplight on the horizon.
Shortly before 3 a.m. on Thursday the 8th of August 1963. Meanwhile, the team of 16 robbers, with the exception of solicitor's clerk Brian Arthur Field, had arrived at their designated locations with their assigned roles in mind. Many of them were incredibly anxious, others were calm, and a select few were completely intoxicated by the thrill of the crimes they were about to embark on. Quite a comical moment occurred when Pops, the train was coming and he lit up a huge smoking pipe with a freshly struck match. And apparently the flame could be seen by everyone. And Pop, obviously, he knew what he was getting into. He knew it was a crime that was about to be committed. But yeah, still wanted a little puff on his pipe. and apparently a big group of the robbers had to run over the tracks to put his smoking pipe out, smack it out of his hand and say, Pops, get off.
I do think I'm putting you as Pops in this.
You're putting me as Pops?
Yeah.
Oh, it only gets worse for Pops though.
Yeah, but a bit older, a bit like not all there.
I don't know. Dan?
Agreed.
Thanks, mate.
And I'm going to be Danny.
Oh,
the one that gets... Okay. Tom?
Level-headed and gets away.
I'm the nasty judge at the end.
Oh, fair enough. Oh, I don't really... Okay, I'll take Pops. So yeah, Pop lit up a huge pipe, smacked out of his hand, and they were all sort of like, Pops, come on.
What are you doing, you freaking idiot? What are you doing? You should know better. You old idiot.
Well, I don't know if they were that mean to him.
Hey, dum-dum!
Oh, yeah.
Cheers, Dan. So yeah, they smacked the pipe away from Pops' hand before the approaching train could see the light from his match. Whilst the muscle and mane robbers began to place masks over their faces and the drivers parked up two Land Rovers and an Austin Lodestar truck underneath Bredigo Bridge, Roger Caudry, the accomplished train robber and track expert that we mentioned in so much detail, jumped swiftly into action. By placing one large heavy glove over the top of the green light of the railroad signal lights, Roger had effectively gotten rid of the green means go. He then tampered with the rear of the signal, where he was able to connect a loose car battery to the wiring of the red light, immediately shining a red light towards the approaching train. So yeah, very not too complex. He's basically hot-wired and rigged the traffic lights for the train.
It reeks to me as if someone's forgotten to bring the thing to block the light. And they go, and one of them's just got gardening gloves in the back. They're like, I've got a glove. Because even that, I just don't trust it. It can't be that big, unless it's a goalie glove to cover the whole thing.
Yeah, Pops, have you bought the blackout paint?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Pops. I got distracted, saw a dog humping another dog. Sorry, lads. It feels like there's a lot better things they can use in there other than a glove to block it.
Yeah. So whether it was a car battery or a couple of loose batteries, he was able to rig the red light to turn it on. And yeah, red lights were not typical whatsoever for the overnight route. But regardless, the train's drivers saw it and immediately started screeching to a halt. Defense solicitor Frank Campion made the following comments on what he deemed as Roger's skills. It's quite a funny comment.
My three-year-old daughter could have done it equally as well as Roger Caudry. He got a glove and placed it over the green light. He got a battery, maybe two batteries and two wires, and he hot-wired up the red light to come on. Isn't that complicated? Thus did the train stop.
I mean, if it's 3-year-old can hotwire, then fair play to her, but...
Unexpectedly encountering a signal stop in this remote location, 26-year-old David Whitby, the train's second crew member, was advised by driver Jack Mills to look into the situation and to try and use a line-side telephone to reach the signalman. So, you know, those old, like, sort of... You see them in the roads and stuff, those old emergency telephone systems. They had them at some points in major parts of the tracks back in the day. Whitby then climbed down from the cab and began to tread over the gravel towards the phone. However, his efforts were thwarted when he discovered that the cables to the phone had been cut in a way that appeared to be intentional. As he ran back towards the train to alert Jack Mills, Whitby was swiftly overpowered by one of the robbers. And simultaneously, other gang members that were cladded in ski masks and balaclavas began to infiltrate the train, as well as the engine cabin from both sides, seizing complete control of the situation and separating the front three carriages from the remaining nine behind it. So this is when our one individual is physically harmed during this, and there's, again, it's very divisive what happens next. As a struggle for the train ensued between Jack Mills and the robbers, he suddenly was smashed over the back of the head with a club, causing him to fall to the ground in a state of semi-unconsciousness. Ronnie Biggs and his retired train driver, Pops, then made their way into the front of the train. But, to the dismay of the rest of the robbers, Pops was unfamiliar with this type of train and therefore unable to drive it. The group began to panic and launch verbal tirades at one another until they noticed that Jack Mills was slowly regaining consciousness. So basically, in Pop's defense, the handbrake was on, from what I'm able to gather.
That's not
it
defense.
Was a diff. It, well, Pops had a puff. It was past his bedtime. He's retired. He was not really supposed to be there, but he's given in. The trains that he used to drive were completely different models. They had completely different handbrakes. And apparently, Jack Mills had obviously put the handbrake on and Pops couldn't work out how to turn it off.
I'm just unsure how different a handbrake can be. A model to model, it can't be. Surely there's a...
Poor old Pops, though. He, you know, a bit out of his depth there. So quickly, the group decide that they are going to force Mills to drive the remaining 800 metres to Bradigo Bridge, and he does so whilst blood continues to seep from the back of his head. As news began to spread, the gang's leaders became incredibly annoyed at both Ronnie Biggs as well as Pops, and so they sent them both away from the train to go and wait at the truck with the other drivers. Gordon Goody would recall the following.
Biggsy was an asshole. I didn't like him. No one did. His one job was to bring a train driver, and he brought a guy who couldn't do the job. They had to go sit in the car. Even the ones who pulled him out of prison had brains way out of Biggsy's league.
And yes, just a note that this was always intended to not be a violent crime as well. So this, someone, one of them hitting them on the head, I think would have annoyed the other people as well, because they didn't want it to be violent. And yeah, someone, it's a bit of adrenaline running, and this would come back to haunt them at a later date. Mills was a 58-year-old man. He was soon to retire as well. So a bit older. And yeah, look, this is a thing that would be looked down upon by a lot of the other criminals within the gang.
It would be alleged, although it's believable, that the injury sustained by Mills in this attack would stay with him and impact him for the rest of his life. But yeah, we'll talk about that more shortly.
As the front three carriages of the train struggled towards Bradigo, the robbers quickly overpowered other post office staff, including the four staff members that were working in the high-value packages coach. The group struck two of them with clubs and threatened them with axes, rapidly gaining access to the high-value packages. So even there, they have used violence later on as well. So, like, this being a... you know, just get on board, take the stuff and run away. It's not worked out that way at all. As they entered the carriage, none of the robbers could believe their eyes. Sat before them was more money than any of them had ever seen in their wildest dreams. As the train stopped above the bridge, everybody jumped into action. The staff members were made to lie face down in the corner of the carriage, whilst drivers Mills and Whitby were brought into the carriage, handcuffed to one another, gagged and sat in the corner facing away from the group. The robbers then formed a human chain towards the edge of the bridge, where they could then drop the bags to other gang members waiting below. Bag by bag, the group managed to loot 120 of the high-value 128 bags within the carriage in just 15 minutes. Together, they stole what was then 2.61 million and what is now 57.9 million. So that is an awful lot of money. Altogether weighing in at 2.5 tons of money. Though I'd say if you nicked 120 bags, why not take just the last eight?
Yeah, I couldn't find exactly what prevented them. I know that some bags had smaller notes in them, and maybe that's why. But I mean, yeah. But also carrying 2.5 tons on the back of that truck that they had as well. It doesn't look like the biggest truck they had.
Mm.
So maybe they couldn't literally carry any more, fit any more. But you'd assume that they would just grab them, wouldn't you? But yeah, either way.
There's a lot of money. The group managed to complete the entire robbery from first stopping the train to ultimately leaving in their vehicles in just 30 minutes. Then they managed to do it all without firing a single bullet. They made the bold claim that they were pretty much unarmed when carrying out the robbery, though some of the men were carrying clubs, and as we mentioned, also axes. Witness testimony from some of the Royal Mail workers suggested that some members of the gang were carrying shotguns, and once the truck was loaded, the getaway began. The truck departed with many of the robbers on board, whilst two Range Rovers using matching number plates also departed the area in slightly different directions, with the remaining robbers squeezing in between the two vehicles. The gang, whilst trying not to wake locals or attract attention, struggled to contain their excitement. They were all listening for police broadcasts on a VHF radio. Each vehicle drives 28 miles to Leverslade Farm, where they transfer the stolen money to the property and gradually dispense to various hideouts across the country. The remaining robbers at Leverslade Farm began to count the money and burst out into song and dance once they cleared the first £1 million mark. They even sat down for a game of Monopoly and used their stolen money instead of the games. Ronnie Biggs recalled the following.
When they reached the first £1 million, everyone was invited down to come and have a look at it. Charlie Wilson was dancing to the twist, Gordon Goody was singing It's a Good Life, and I would say the general euphoria touched us all.
At the farm, the group closed off the count at 2.61 million before dividing it equally into 16 separate shares. They share a few celebratory drinks as well as putting together several piles of what they referred to as drinks, and these drinks basically meant smaller cash sums for other gang members of their own relevant gangs. So they wanted to kick back, you know, it might have been £10,000-£15,000, which again is a lot of money at that time, a lot of money now, to gang members that didn't take part in the heist, but they wanted to look after. Whilst they were doing this, whilst they were trying to celebrate but also stay quiet, alternating members of the gang would be lookouts from the front-facing bedroom at the top of the farmhouse. Each of the 16 members got approximately £150,000 for their part, however small or big their part in the robbery was. So this was roughly just under £4 million each. So people very quickly point to Ronnie Biggs, for example, and say that he got £4 million and became, for a long period of time, Britain's most wanted fugitive for recruiting a train driver that could not drive a train.
Yeah, I mean, if I was part of the gang, I would be very angry at Biggs and Pops getting anything.
Yeah, Pops, just to clarify, Pops only got, I think it was pre-agreed, 30 grand. I think that's what Pops got, which is still, that's like, what, that's got to be 1 million. Yeah, couldn't quite deliver when it came to it. Over the following day, the gang members laid low and began laundering their stolen cash, using various methods to try and conceal their involvement in the robbery. They do this whilst continuing to listen to the VHF radios in hopes of learning the police's movements in regards to tracking them down. So, yeah, a few hours after the robbery, they overhear an announcement to say that they've found the train and police are aware that a train has been robbed. And now what happens next will ultimately get them on the run. It is announced that one of the Royal Mail employees told the police that one of the robbers said, "Don't move," for half an hour, which is kind of specific, I guess, but it's also kind of loose at the same time. Ultimately, this witness's testimony led police to believe that the gang were hiding within a 30-minute radius of the bridge. The police then began what is known as a dragnet tactic within a 30-mile radius of the scene of the crime. So this included basically containing that area, setting up roadblocks, traffic stops, searching houses, vacant buildings, conducting raids, starting surveillance operations, interviewing locals, and looking out for specific vehicles. So an important note to make is that Leverslade Farm was just 28 miles away, so it fell into this dragnet radius that they were searching. And yeah, a few of the Royal Mail employees had kind of given vague descriptions of the truck and the Range Rovers. So yeah, the police would announce a £10,000 or ranging between £10,000 and £15,000 reward for any information leading to any of the robbers' captures. So yeah, the public were also hot on trying to find these criminals. The robbers, now knowing Leverslade was not safe, cut their celebrations short and quickly made the decision to flee their hideout. Brian Field, the solicitor's clerk, attended Leverslade in order to pick up his share of the takings and to take Roy James back to London with him, where the pair agreed that Roy James would pick up an extra vehicle to come back and escape with other group members in. The plan was then for Brian Field to completely clean up Leverslade Farm and remove any kind of incriminating evidence. But this was never done.
I also heard an account that apparently someone was going to go there and burn the place down after they left, and that was never done as well. So yeah, lots of key evidence was left at the scene. On Friday the 9th of August 1963, the remainder of the group arranged with their wives and close family members to collect them, before eventually Leverslade was empty. As a result of Brian Field not providing the clean-up operation at the farm, huge amounts of evidence was left behind, including two Range Rovers seen at the scene with matching number plates, hundreds of empty post office mail bags, £800 in 10 shilling notes, a flatbed truck which had been half painted yellow, clothing, a pair of Gordon Goody shoes marked with paint, sleeping bags, the Monopoly board covered in real money, a large amount of food, thousands of fingerprints, and unbelievably, the new agreed property purchase documents all in Brian Clark's name. Even if you knew someone was coming in to clear up after you, you'd still do a bit of that, I would have thought.
All the documentaries I watched, all of the other robbers said that Brian Clark's one job, he'd obviously given them the tip of the train, but his one job was to clean up the property afterwards. And whether that meant burn it down or literally clean it up, he didn't. And he makes another mistake very soon after this, which is just ridiculous. For a man of his alleged intelligence, it all starts to unwind after this.
Monday the 12th of August 1963, just 4 days after the robbery, with growing adoration for the robbers, police experience a slight stroke of luck when they find and arrest Roger Caudry in Bournemouth together with his friend Bill Bowl.
Baggins.
Roger was renting a garage from what happened to be a police officer's widow, who informed police of her suspicions when she saw Roger carrying a large amount of cash from his car. Roger was taken to the station and immediately interviewed by Detective Sergeant Jack Slipper of the Flying Squad. Slipper. It's a great name.
Who do we have the other? Swindle and Slipper on the case.
During the interrogation, it was clear that Roger was uncomfortable as he was not able to sit still for even a few seconds. Eventually, he asked Detective Slipper for a doctor because he had a car key up his arse. So he slipped a car key up his arse. After retrieving the key, he informed police that the car that the key unlocked was concealed in £150,000, and he was one of the robbers. They then pressured him into giving details of the other's whereabouts and headed immediately towards Lever Slave Farm, where they found piles of incriminating and very obvious evidence. Roger remained adamant he did not know any of the other robbers' names. A key up the bum. Some harm done.
Definitely, yeah, especially, well, hand. You'd imagine handle last.
In that those days, the car key wouldn't be as bulky, would it? It'd be one of the smaller keys.
Yeah, probably too big to eat.
Pardon?
The car key is probably too big to try and swallow.
It'd do less. You'd do more damage doing that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Pops wouldn't have done that. I'm just trying to think at what point
Pops key
in arse. At one point, maybe this was all a very quick thing for him.
Oh, I don't think he sat there and thought this is a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm sure it reeks of a man in a desperate situation, but.
And it must, yeah, he was wobbling on it, sort of sitting on the chair like this, cheek to cheek. Yeah. But fair play, he didn't incriminate any of his co-heist members. On Thursday, the 15th of August, 1963, Brian Fields' £150,000 is found abandoned in a wooded area in Woking, and it's found in an embossed suitcase by a pair of dog walkers who immediately called police. The police then searched the suitcase to find an invoice from a German hotel, which was addressed to Mr. and Mrs. Brian Field. So again, Brian Field just very, very, very loose and lazy with his role, and quite a serious role in this robbery. They immediately track him down, and despite being the one that initially sourced and shared the details of the high-value train, Brian Field had made several glaring errors, which would ultimately lead to the majority of the gang's demise. Norman Parker, a close friend of many of the robbers, said the following on Brian Field.
He was a nice enough guy, Brian, but from a criminal point of view, totally naive. He had a sort of hail fellow, well-met persona. I think he thought all of it was very much sort of a jolly game. And I suppose, in and amongst the criminal fraternity, we've got a name for that sort of person. We call them a silly bollocks.
Yeah, Brian Arthur Field definitely equates to a silly bollocks. The following month, Brian Arthur Field was arrested, and it is believed that he gave up and incriminated a vast majority of the rest of the robbers. Over the coming days, weeks and months, at least 11 of the 16 robbers were arrested, including Ronnie Biggs, Charlie Wilson, Gordon Goody and Tommy Wisby. But Bruce Reynolds and Buster Edwards remained at large. All are charged with conspiracy to commit robbery, and the majority of them were arrested in the London area. Other members of the gang are arrested the following year as police continue their investigation and continue to track down suspects connected to the robbery. Detective Sergeant Jack Slipper, Superintendent Tommy Butler, and their teams were responsible for a large volume of the arrests. And yeah, Tommy Butler basically came on to replace Jack Slipper, as this spanned a great number of years. But he performed so well and so ruthlessly in hunting down the rest of the robbers that he was given the nickname The Thief Taker.
I think even the robbers themselves had some respect for Tommy Butler, and they thought he knew what was what. He was well versed in kind of the criminal underworld, and yeah, they kind of feared him and respected him at the same time. On the 20th of January 1964, the trial of 11 of the robbers began, and due to there being so much press attention and a large number of lawyers being required for each of the robbers, the government converted offices surrounding Aylesbury Crown Court to make the courtroom large enough to house everybody. The trial lasted for 51 days and ended with seven of the men being found guilty and sentenced to what many believe was used to make an example of the group, 30 years in prison each, for a crime of sordid violence inspired by vast greed. Whilst the other four received lesser sentences, ranging from 3 all the way up to 25-year sentences, not all of the robbers gave up their stolen money, with many of them claiming they had lost it or thrown it. All the houses were searched thoroughly, but very little of it was found. Many of them hid it in unique parts of England, including burying it, placing it at the bottom of a pond, hiding it in chimneys, and storing it in a car engine, as the net of the investigators were closing in on them. So yes, you'd put it in the pond, Dan?
Just about to ask that.
Yeah, I was just literally thinking of that, yeah.
So if you boys had £150,000 in cash, what would you imagine that's about a briefcase worth?
Yeah.
And you knew the police had your name and address, and you knew they were coming for you. You had a day to hide it somewhere. What would you do?
Up your ass.
Oh, okay. Am I willing on that? Or
I always are.
Okay. Dan?
The pond would be a good one for you, Dan, for you to put there.
What about under the pond, Dan? Like, dig up the lino quickly and stick it under the pond, and I think it's a pond. There's no way to put it there.
Bang on, mate.
Have to drain the pond, yeah. though, and that'd be difficult, I'd have thought.
Suck a hose pipe.
Suck a hose pipe.
Very
difficult. I wouldn't do it anywhere in my house or anywhere close to my house. The idea of burying it in a woodland is not ideal, but maybe get one of those crab cages and put it in the ocean and then have it like in a suitcase in the crab cage.
Okay, yeah.
I recently went to Whitby and I saw a lot of crab cages. So that's fresh in my mind.
Fresh on the mind, yeah. I'm thinking of that No Country for Old Men movie where he has got the suitcase and he hides it in an air vent around the corner of an air vent. That's pretty good. I like the idea of burying it and not necessarily on your own property. So like I drive to Scotland or something and find a bit of land and bury it there and just make sure I remember where I buried it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't see that going wrong.
No, same. I forgot the shovel.
I've got a glove. Why is my khaki covered in shit?
So we're going with crab trap under the pond and buried in Scotland.
Yeah.
Cool.
If it's nowadays, though, your car's being tracked all the way.
Yeah, that's true. But, yeah. So I'd have to go somewhere on foot.
Well, you live in...
Oh, there's got to be a smart way.
There's another name.
No, all right. Okay, careful. I'm trying to think of a really creative way to hide this money because I'm sure there's a good idea somewhere.
Let's move on. To Scotland.
Why don't you, you could wallpaper over it.
It's just not good content.
No. Yeah.
A man thinking.
August 12th, 1964. Under the cover of midnight, a three-man team broke into Winston Green Prison in Birmingham, where in less than 3 minutes, they broke out Charlie Wilson. In yet another huge twist in the Great Train Robbers case, Wilson then got hold of his hidden money under a pond, in a crab trap, or up in Scotland. I don't know which option he picked. He then fled to Paris, where he underwent extensive amounts of plastic surgery. The following year, he made the decision to fly to Mexico City using a false passport. Once there, he met up with old friends Bruce Reynolds and Buster Edwards, who had been in hiding all over different parts of South and Central America. So that's quite interesting. They are able to find each other, even back then with the technologies available. Those three were able to find each other very, very quickly. The police had no idea that Bruce and Buster were over in Mexico.
Plastic surgery, you know, that's going big, isn't it?
Next level, yeah. Next level.
July of 1965, just 11 months after Charlie Wilson escaped, so too did Ronnie Biggs. A recently released prisoner named Paul Seaborn arranged the breakout with two other ex-convicts. The two Ronnies, Fort Candles, Ronnie Black and Ronnie Leslie, they used a huge wooden ladder to allow Biggs to escape over the prison walls before fleeing into the night. Biggs was smuggled over to Paris, where he too underwent a significant amount of plastic surgery, paid for with his hidden loot. Do you think they just always wanted plastic surgery and they're like, they're using this as an excuse? His face is exactly the same, he's just got some boobs. Biggs then fled to Australia for several years until Interpol tipped off UK police that he was seen working in Melbourne as a set constructor for Australian Channel 9. He then moved to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and once in Brazil, despite having three children with his wife Charmaine, Biggs got a Brazilian lady pregnant who eventually gave birth to a son. This inadvertently gave Biggs legal immunity from the British police chasing him, and as a result he appeared openly in several television interviews and became somewhat of a folk hero for the British public, and would always appear in British tabloids over the next 50 years. Biggs recalled the following.
One report said that my time on the run, I've had 2,500 girlfriends. I mean, you've got to realise that I've been on the run for more than 30 years. I've got to have more than that. I don't have any intentions to return to England. I would go back if I could return as a free person. I don't want to return to a prison. I am no longer a criminal. I gave up that practice years ago.
I love how Biggs has given the bigger one when he essentially was an absolute shit show.
Yeah, yeah. His plastic surgery as well, it doesn't look like he's changed his appearance too much. He just looks more awake.
Yeah, I'm seeing his trousers, mate.
Oh, that's why you called Ronnie Biggs.
No, he's got smaller. He's reduced. I'm Ronnie Nubbin.
So Ronnie Biggs remained in Brazil for the next 36 years until May of 2001, during which time a very infamous photo would be taken for Ronnie's 70th birthday, where he was joined by Bruce Reynolds for the celebrations. And yeah, that photo was all over the British press at the time. Between the year 2000 and 2001, Ronnie suffered a series of strokes and reluctantly made the decision to return to England, despite knowing that he would be arrested upon arrival. He stated that he did not return to England for medical reasons and that he only wanted to go back home in order to, quote, walk into a pub in Margate as an Englishman and buy a pint of bitter.
I'll have a pint of bitter.
Unsurprisingly, Biggs was arrested on his arrival in England and served 12 years in prison before being released on compassionate grounds. He passed away on the 18th of December 2013, aged 84. Bruce Reynolds was on the run for 5 years before he was finally caught and arrested. Though he was sentenced to serve 25 years in prison, he only served 9 before being released. He died on the 28th of February 2013, aged 81. Buster Edwards turned himself in after running out of money in September of 1966. He served 9 years in prison before being released early. He sadly died on the 28th of November 1994, aged 61, in what was believed to be a suicide. Charlie Wilson continued a life of crime after being released from prison. On the 24th of April 1990, he was found shot dead at his villa in Marbella. Charlie Wilson's murder has since been linked to drug dealers in the area. Danny Pembroke is believed to have been the only named gang member who was never caught, alongside the other men who have remained unidentified since the robbery itself. The identity of the senior Royal Mail officer has never been confirmed. Many of the robbers lived long and happy lives once outside of prison, becoming national heroes and making public appearances, writing books and appearing in different films and TV shows. Many of them purchased several houses, fancy cars, opened up their own pubs, bars and nightclubs, whilst others decided to live a more secluded life away from the public eye. In terms of Jack Mills, the train driver, there were numerous interviews with him over the years and relatives of his and police officers that were involved in investigating the robbery. There were differing claims. All of the robbers, you basically said he just got a bop on the head and that was that. But obviously, he was pretty well bandaged in all of the media appearances he subsequently made. People suggest that he had head trauma for the rest of his life and that had a knock-on effect in him developing Alzheimer's. There are also claims that he never truly recovered from this incident, and it was also a knock-on effect of him later developing leukemia. Sadly, his relatives remain adamant that they were not fairly compensated, whilst all of the individuals that were responsible for this happening to him were treated like royalty, which left a very bitter taste in their mouth.
To mention, as I said, there's lots of interviews with people, the public, general public at the time of this, where people were really on board with the robbers, thinking, you know, sticking one in the eye of the rich, and it's kind of like a Robin Hood story. But yeah, the Jack Mills thing, obviously, it's different claims, like Ben said, but this, of course, would affect someone for the rest of their lives, you know, the fear and also just being anxious and having a blade to the back of the head, it also will lead to medical issues as well. So, we don't want to forget the victim in this case as well. Like Jack Mills, it was very sad what happened to him as well. We're not glorifying the events of the day.
So that was the case of the Great Train Robbery, our finale for Series 9. In terms of some aftermath, I'm going to do a little throwback, if that's okay.
Ooh!
Ship me in. Push me in.
Ship me in.
Don't ship me in. Push me in. Play me in.
Ben Carter's Interesting Facts.
Interesting Facts. I don't know. Interesting Facts.
Okay, welcome back. Welcome back. Hope everyone's had a rocking year so far. Almost halfway. A third of the way through the year. Wow. In terms of all-time heists committed on record in the UK, after aggregating them to modern-day value, the Great Train Robbery currently sits in sixth place at 57.9 million. So the five others, and then there's also one more that is contentious, I'll go through now. So at number five, we have the 1975 Bank of America heist in Mayfair, London, with the robbers netting a cool £71.4 million. In at number four, we have the 2006 Securitas Depot robbery in Tunbridge, Kent, £81.4 million.
Cool.
Mega. Ooh, mega. In at number three, we have the 1983 Brinks Matt robbery at Heathrow Airport, London, £93.3 million. Tricky figure.
Wowza.
Yeah, dearie me.
That's a lot of coin.
It's a lot of coin, man. Whoa.
You get free bitcoins for that now.
In at number two, we have the 1987 Knightsbridge security deposit robbery, unsurprisingly, in Knightsbridge, London. £124.7 million.
Whoa, fucking hell, boy.
Oof, then this one, boys, gather round. The 1990 City Bonds robbery on Nicholas Lane, Central London. And we could do an episode on this because this is apparently the mafia were involved, the cartel were involved, the British criminal underworld were involved, high-ranking senior officials were involved. £705.8 million.
Stinky money.
Fucking hell, that's a lot of dust.
That stinks.
And in 1990, that's probably like a billion now, you know.
Easily.
Easy.
Yeah. Then some people say, look, Ben, that's not the real list. You've missed a big one out. In at the real number one, the 2001 theft of Charles Darwin's notebooks from Cambridge University Library. Priceless.
They're propping up my kitchen table right now. No, I'm only kidding you. I'm kidding you. Don't check it. Don't look under Dan's pond.
Yeah.
Or up Ben's Scotland.
Scottish hole.
It's his lock. Lock and key. It makes all sense now, doesn't it?
So there you have it. We look forward to seeing you again in season 10. Wow. Yes. If we get renewed.
Are you bringing it back soon?
I don't know. Maybe we'll try something new.
Ooh.
I think Cryptic Clues might alternate because Tom did a good one the other week. And people seem to like guessing them as well.
Yeah, no, I think I like Cryptic Clues, definitely. 100%. Yeah. I think a little splattering of interesting facts.
Yeah, it can kind of come and go as it pleases, like a midnight train.
That's not really come and go as it pleases, really. It's kind of strict schedule. It follows a thing. It's routine. Yeah,
never on time, though, are they? Well, done myself there, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see you again soon.
Dozens upon dozens of films, books, and television series have been made about or inspired by the Great Train Robbery, including a ludicrous number of biographies and autobiographies been written about the events in an understandable attempt to cash in. These have been released so far by 7 different members of the gang, with Ronnie Biggs having involvement in at least 6 of the separate books. At the same time, 5 different detectives and senior investigators have released books of their own perspectives of the heist.
How can Ronnie write 6 separate books about basically bringing along Pops?
Yeah.
There's only so much you can say.
I fucked up. I messed up. And yes, Buster Edwards was played by Phil Collins in the 1998 film Buster, alongside Larry Lamb playing Bruce Reynolds and Julie Walters playing June Edwards. And there are a lot of orchestral versions of Phil Collins songs that are unashamedly used throughout the film, as well as the debut of Going Loco Down in Acapulco, which Phil Collins co-wrote. The real-life Buster Edwards played a small cameo in and around the hour mark of the film. At the point where Phil Collins, who is playing Buster, is arrival at the Acapulco airport, he is seen walking out of the airport with his girlfriend, played by Phil Collins' real-life wife. My favourite fact is Phil Collins divorced his wife once via fax. The film received mixed to poor reviews, with many major outlets stating that it's a glorified crime, and Phil Collins personally told Prince Charles and Princess Diana to cancel their planned appearance at the film premiere due to the fact that their association with the film may hurt their image. Notorious film critic Roger Ebert gave the following feedback.
Buster is played with surprising effectiveness by rock star Phil Collins, who looks and sounds like a gentler Bob Hoskins. It's too squeaky clean to be believable, but this is an entertaining fairy tale view of law breaking.
Yeah, I remember watching it as a kid, and I feel like Phil Collins had a lot of creative control on this film because they really try and make him look like the good guy, even though he does terrible things like rob all these people. There's a scene where he steals a load of toys from a toy store for his kid. Then later, when he's arriving in Acapulco, he punches his wife in a market square. And you're still like left trying to root. Well, the film tries to get you to root for him. It's like he's terrible. He's a terrible person. And Buster in real life was allegedly a terrible person. But yeah, Collins. It's really weird how they still try and make him out throughout the film to be the good guy when he does all these awful things throughout the whole movie. And all of his songs keep popping up as well. Well worth a watch.
Don't know if you sold it to me, but yeah, the Bob Hoskins comparisons. Definitely a good one there.
One last thing before we leave you for the series. I thought I'd do something because a burning question within the cult, our Discord, our Facebook group, who would run the better gang, Tommy Norris or Danny Lamb? It's time for Ben Carter's Gangsters or Shams.
Benjamin Carter's Gangsters or Shams. Choose the right answer or you're brown bread. Dead.
Very good.
So basically, I had this all kind of lined up for our Grey Twins episode, but unfortunately, we went over time slightly on that one. What I've got for you, it's Ben Carter's Gangsters or Shams. It's up to you boys to decide whether you recruit legitimate gangsters to your gang, or if you allow Ben Carter's Shamsters to slip through the net and join your ranks.
Choo-choo.
Yeah, hoo-hoo. So what I'm going to do is give you their names, their nicknames, and their backstory, and feel free to play at home. We have gangster member number 1, Cyrus Dabu, aka Cyrus the Ghost. During the 1960s, a Persian-Dutch jewel thief arrived in London, having fled mainland Europe after a series of cunning and daring heists. As he gradually earned respect from his peers, Cyrus Dabou established himself as a thief who could steal anything without leaving a single trace of his presence behind, quickly earning himself the nickname, and quite a good play on his surname, Cyrus the Ghost.
Ooh.
Okay, is Cyrus Dabou, aka Cyrus the Ghost, joining your gang?
Yes.
Dan?
Yes.
You've both been shammed. You've allowed a shamster into your ranks.
No.
Okay.
Fuck's sake.
Don't worry. Next up, Jonathan Jellyfish Johnny Clark. During the 1930s, there were two very well-known criminals on the loose in America, and they also happened to be lovers, Bonnie and Clyde. What is not known is that Bonnie and Clyde actually had their own gang and took a lot of the spotlight away from them, irritating some members of the gang in the process. Step forward, Jonathan Clark, aka Jellyfish Johnny. Initially a lower-level gang member and petty thief, he earned his nickname The Jellyfish and Jellyfish Johnny due to his ability to slip away from almost any situation the gang found themselves in, and his ability to suddenly sting rivals with unexpected moves. Sadly, Jellyfish Johnny died at the age of just 27 when he was thrown from a 14th floor hotel room by a rival gang member.
I'm lost now because I was so sure about the first one.
Cyrus Dabou.
I'm going to go Sham.
Okay. Tom's going with Sham.
Just give me the name again of that guy.
Jonathan Jellyfish Johnny Clark, aka The Jellyfish.
Sign him up. Come on.
Sign him up. Okay, so Dan, you've got two shamsters in your gang. Tom, well done.
Fucking hell!
Okay, moving on, we have Tony Big Tuna Accardo. During the 1920s, Mr. Tony Accardo was pretty much gangster royalty. He is basically a very interesting inclusion on this list because he actually had two nicknames, Tony Joey Batters and Tony Big Tuna, Battered Tuna. The reason why they called him Big Tuna is because on a trip with the gang, he reeled in a 400-pound tuna off the coast of Florida. And there's actually a photo of him taken with the beast. And it went quite viral between gangs, earning Big Tony the nickname Big Tuna.
Tuna!
I'm going to go with get him in my gang.
Dan?
Yeah, sign him up. Go on, step in line.
Okay, you've both got your first legit gangster. Here he is. It's Tony Big Tuna. And there's a little picture of Tony with the tuna for you.
Wedgeport.
Yeah, big old tuna for Tony. After Tony, we have Jake. Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik. During the late 1920s, Mr. Jake Guzik rose to prominence as number two man behind the Chicago mobster Al Capone. Guzik took on the role of Capone's principal accountant and treasurer. And the reason why they called him Greasy Thumb, any guesses, boys?
I'm guessing something to do with cars.
Oh, okay.
Something to do with the diner.
Something to do with a diner. Great shout. Diner range out now. He was called Greasy Thumb due to the fact that he regularly walked around the streets of Chicago without carrying a weapon on him and instead carrying a substantial sum of at least $1,000 in his pockets at all times, earning him the nickname Greasy Thumb. So basically anyone that made threats towards him, he'd just pay them off. Greasy Thumbs at Greasy Thumb.
Cowardly. Yeah. I don't want him in my gang.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if he is real.
Is he a gangster or a shamster?
If he's got a lot of money, though, it's quite a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
For the gang.
$1,000 at any time isn't like a too made-up figure, right?
I don't think Ben would associate Greasy Thumb with having money, because it's just even... Because I don't think... Well, I don't know, to be fair. That my brain wouldn't go there at all. I don't think Ben's would. So I'm going to say he is real.
Okay.
Just to be the opposite, I'm going to go sham.
Okay, well, step forward, Greasy Thumb. He's a real-life gangster. There he is. There's Greasy Thumb for you. From Greasy Thumb to Bubblegum, we have Benjamin Bubblegum Benny Wright. So during the mid-1970s, Mr. Benjamin David Wright was a man to be feared amongst Glasgow's rising ganglands. There were more than 20 different gangs in Glasgow at the time, but the one man feared by all of them, despite his fairly sweet nickname, was Bubblegum Benny. Benny rose to prominence via his association with the Glasgow Tongs, the Santoy, the Bingo Boys, and the Fleet. Ultimately, he would be known for his sweet talk and constantly blowing bubbles whilst holding meetings, making deals, and even torturing and killing people. Benjamin then earned his nickname, Bubblegum Benny.
Going to go first, Dan?
I'm going to go Sham. Absolute
I'm
Sham.
Sham.
Well done, but boys, you dodged a bubblegum bullet there. He is a shamster, but those gang names were real for the Glasgow scene at the time. Okay, very interesting individual up next. Tyan Little Danger Makuti. Little Danger is his nickname. During the late 2010s, Mr. Tyan Makuti was involved in a string of robberies along Birmingham's jewellery quarter, eventually being arrested and sentenced to 12 years for shooting a jeweller in the arm. However, unlike most of the people on this list, Mr. Makuti earned his nickname Little Danger after he was placed in prison. So when he was arrested, an Instagram account called Little Danger posted a series of photos of Mr. Makuti from behind bars, including a rap video where he stated the following: "Don't think of that guy coming to test me. I'll be getting bags like Tetley, sitting on my Burberry with my neck piece." Neck piece are basically expensive necklaces. This, together with a series of photos of the 5 foot 6 inch tall man, earned him the nickname Little Danger.
Danny boy.
Little Danger.
I thought Dan would do a good Little Danger.
Little Danger, I'll come at ya.
Yeah, go on, sign him up.
Sign him up.
I want to just go to a different sham.
Little Danger is a gangster. And there,
come on,
there
baby.
He is. Dan, you've got your first, is that your first or second gangster?
They've got a couple.
Hello. No.
And finally, we have Mr. Sambafal, a.k.a. Smugsy Ace. So we're concluding our list with a very notorious individual. During the early 2020s, so the most recent one on our list, Mr. Sambafal, who is a member of the dreaded 23 Drillers gang, went viral on social media after he was involved in a mass gang brawl at Resorts World in the Midlands. During the near 30-man brawl, one member from each of the gangs was cut with a knife, whilst Mr. Sambafal was the only person to fall, so Fal fell, after being knocked out cold. From footage of the fight going viral, it was revealed that he was in fact Coventry's most popular unsigned drill artist that had been knocked out. Not only a gang name, but a stage name, Smugsy Ace.
Well, just going by the name, I don't want someone smug on my team, so...
Yeah, okay.
Nah, sham.
Get him in.
Congrats, Tom. Here's Smugsy.
Fuck's sake.
I feel like you've got a nice blend there. So you've got some gangsters and you've got some shams each, but I think Tom just pipped it.
My gang versus your gang, Dan, I guess. So we'll find out.
I'm up for it. I'll meet you after school, yeah? Outside.
By the bike sheds.
Oh.
Yep.
There you go.
And we just want to say a huge thank you to everyone that has listened to this series or watched this series, shared this series. It's been an absolute pleasure and we appreciate it more than you ever know. A huge thank you to our editor, Ben Bonsi, for this series. Always much appreciated. A big shout out to Ben Aitken and also to Josh Carter.
Yeah, nice one, Tom. I wouldn't mind just giving a quick shout out to the amazing team over at Fourth Wall. As many of you know, we transitioned from Patreon to Fourth Wall. It's been an amazing experience. As a lot of our members say, it's so much better than Patreon ever was. It works better, it's smoother than Patreon, it's way more interactive. So if you haven't checked out icmap.co.uk, please do. The sign-up costs are lower than ever, lower than Patreon ever was. But genuinely, if you don't know who Fourth Wall are, if you're a creative or you're interested in getting into this sort of field, please check out fourthwall.com. They essentially host an amazing platform for creatives like yourselves to monetize what you do. And it's exactly what we're doing, and they've made it so easy. And if anybody is actually a creative on Patreon, they offer a complete content import from Patreon to Fourth Wall. So you don't have to do anything. It's just a click of a button. And the main thing is your landing site, so ours is icmap.co.uk, can look phenomenal, better than just a Patreon feed. So, sorry if this sounds like a sponsored ad. It's really not. We just love the team at Fourth Wall. They've supported us so much this year. They've enabled us and allowed us to do what we love and monetize the content that we enjoy doing. We couldn't have done it without you. Thank you so much.
So we're going to be going away for our preparation for Series 10 not sure exactly how long that will take to get all of the episodes in, but do comment below on the cases you'd love to see in Series 10, because we do listen to everybody's feedback. In the meantime, we will be releasing weekly episodes, weekly minisodes over at icmap.co.uk, which at the time of recording, I think there's 152 episodes there now, some really interesting cases. So why not come and join the cult if you can't wait until Series 10? icmap.co.uk. We really appreciate anyone's support.
And if you guys cast your mind back to last week, I got Ben a little bit with a little cheeky AI number, well, a couple, and I thought,
why not do a nice little message to you, our gorgeous listeners, of a little song from there as well. But like we always say...
We say this all the time.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Unless it's kind of bringing pops anywhere that you shouldn't be.
Definitely.
I guess that's, we've established that. Hiding your money under a pond.
Keep the arse.
Well,
but yes, anyway. Hit it, Dan.
Going loco.
In the heart of the country, on the airwaves so clear, a podcast whispered secrets for all the world to hear. But now it's time to say goodbye, to bid a fond farewell to Tom, Ben, and the voices we love so well. They brought us laughter and they brought us tears, a journey through the seasons, through the passing years. Their stories touched our souls, resonated deep within. Now it's time to say goodbye and let the podcast end. So raise a glass to the podcast, to the memories we made. Though Series 9 may be the end, in our hearts it will not fade. To Tom, Ben, and Dan, we'll forever raise a cheer. Keep doing what you're doing, for we'll be back for Series 10, my dear.
See you later. To Pip.
Cheers.
Goodbye. See you soon.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.